Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined as always by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton. And Tim, I speak to you on Friday morning after the Mets win a 4-1 game on Thursday, but I can't help but thinking, is this the future Sandy Alderson wants?
You know,
Three of their four runs scoring on bases loaded walks, perhaps the least exciting way a run can score in baseball. The fourth coming on an honest to God single from Dom Smith, the great Dom Smith. But, the 75% of the runs in that game, a win, a beautiful outing from Taijuan Walker, soiled in some way by the lack of offensive excitement.
You know, I didn't add it up. Usually, I keep track of how long each half inning takes. And I did yesterday, so I could do the math eventually. I feel like the Mets were at bat for, the game was 3 hours and 19 minutes long, for approximately 3 hours and 17 minutes of that game. Like, the Cardinals were up for two batters. It was Paul Goldschmidt and Nolan Arenado in the ninth inning. That's the only time I remember the Cardinals being up at the plate with a chance to do anything.
And, you know, I joke about the way they score the runs, but at watching the game, it's like, you know, there's runners on base and you're rooting for hits, but they're not getting any pitches to hit because the guys on the Cardinals couldn't throw a strike. So it was like every time in the rare instance they did throw a strike, it was almost so surprising that you couldn't really even blame a guy for not swinging or fouling one off because it was like one in every six pitches was a strike.
Yeah, it was it wasn't the most fun game to watch. The Mets have had a couple of their better wins of, you know, like important wins of the season. And I think that was an important win on Thursday to get a series split there and finish off a winning road trip for them at 4-3. You go back to like the home opener win against the Marlins, which was an important win for them. Also not your favorite to watch as a fan in many regards. So hopefully, I know it's so Bronx, it's so Yankees to complain about the way the team is winning.
For too many homers.
It's not entertaining enough. But hopefully the rest of the season contains fewer games like this, just from a purely aesthetic standpoint, than anything.
I'll take them. You know, ultimately, if it's a win is a win, and some signs of hope all around here. We saw Francisco Lindor finally get off the schneid with a hit. He sounded understandably pretty happy about that. And some nice contributions from with several guys hurt, with J.D. Davis and Brandon Nimmo, who had been their two best hitters, basically both on the disabled list. Luis Guillorme also on the the injured list. And yet now we're seeing contributions from Jonathan VR, Kevin Pillar, sort of up and down the roster, feeling maybe a little bit better about this team's depth.
Yeah, I mean, you start with Lindor, who the ninth inning single was really important just from a results standpoint and just getting some confidence. Like there is no longer an 0-for countdown for him each at bat, which is good. But you really take the overall six plate appearances that he had on Thursday. Five of them were good, I would say. He walked three times. He got the single. He also barreled the ball up to center field, hit one pretty well, I think in his second at-bat or second plate appearance. When a guy walks a bunch, yesterday the Mets didn't really have at-bats. They had plate appearances. The one you didn't like was, of course, striking out with the bases loaded or with two men on in the fourth inning. But outside of that, I thought he looked much better, more comfortable at the plate. You saw fewer bad swings. I mean, that's been the thing about his slump, right, is that it hasn't been a lot of, like, hard hit contact and good swings that have gotten.
It's different from the Jeff McNeil thing we talked about at the beginning of the season. It feels like a legit slump. He was not seeing the ball.
Right, like baseball neophytes like you and I can see that he doesn't look his best. This is not the way he's supposed to look. And as that game went on, you saw more and more, like, this is more who he's supposed to look like. And so you hope that carries over into the weekend against Arizona. And then with the bench, you go to Wednesday's second game where it was Pilar, VR, and Tomas Nito probably had the biggest hit of that game, the two-run homer to get them on the board early. Like, those guys, I think they all had two hits. They all had two RBIs. They had all the RBIs in the game. They scored seven runs. Each of those guys had two RBIs. So the Mets have talked for years about building a better bench, and I think we have jumped on opportunities like this in the past to say they have done it. They have built their better bench and been wrong. So I'm not going to say that off of a seven-inning contest. But their bench won them that game, and their bench has helped them a fair amount early in the season. A couple big hits by Pilar and VR and now Nito. That's been help really crucial to them as they've dealt with a couple injuries early in the season.
And with Pilar and VR, I think you can make the point that, and this is in contrast with several of the bench, pieces that the Mets have relied on in the past. Those guys are major leaguers, right? And you pay for actual major league contract major leaguers, and you maybe get a little more than you would from a league minimum type guy or a quad A type guy that you're sort of hoping will ascend into the role of big league bench player.
Yeah, I mean, you invest. Those guys are each making a few million. They're not the up and, you're not handing a bench spot to. We're so mean to Eric Campbell. I'm sorry, Eric. Not handing
a very
a bench
nice
spot.
Guy.
And a manager for the Norwich Sea Unicorns this summer.
That's a team, the Sea Unicorns?
Yeah. It's basically like...
It's like twice over not a thing, right? Because there's no unicorn, and there's certainly no sea unicorn.
They're essentially the narwhals, but, narwhals are sea unicorns. It's like a kenning, the old Viking thing where you don't refer to anything by its actual thing. You use a weird metaphor.
I didn't know that's a Viking thing, but as we've noted, our Scandinavian expert, so I'll take your word for it.
I think it's by. Oh, I hope I didn't get it wrong. Now, they took over for the Connecticut Tigers, who had taken over for the Norwich Navigators, but they're not actually an affiliated. But whatever, we're getting off track. We've seen the Mets in the past like give those bench spots to minor league free agents and guys who had who weren't quite ready for that role, and that's a really hard role. It's hard when you're coming up and you haven't earned everyday playing time in the major leagues because still you've been playing every day in the minor leagues. So you're adjusting to a higher level of competition at the same time that you're adjusting to not seeing it on a daily basis. And it's also hard for a veteran, for veterans like Pilar and VR, because they are used to for a very long time playing every day and now they're not. And I think it makes sense that they are playing their best now when they're getting a little bit more regular playing time. And I think Luis Rojas did a pretty good job, I know, to the complaints of much of the fan base in getting Kevin Pillar some semblance of regular playing time in the first couple of weeks so that he could take advantage of a time like this.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Bobby Valentine Sunday lineup a little bit, which people used to complain about like way back in the day. Why are all these bench guys getting this much playing time? But you're going to need those guys at some point, and you do kind of want to keep them seeing balls and getting regular, semi-regular plate appearances. So when you do need to count on them, then they're not just thrown in there cold. But I want to move to the pitching side of things. On one hand, like I said, another great performance from Taijuan Walker, perhaps is almost certainly his best to date. Seven innings, one unearned run, and 18 straight retired, I think, to end the game. Turns it over to Trevor May for yet another clean inning in the eighth. May has been great, and then Edwin Diaz allowed a couple of singles, but locked down the ninth inning. The concern, though, is that Jacob deGrom has missed a start. Now, as of Friday when we're speaking, he is on track to start Sunday. He is pitching on the heels of a terrific feature you wrote about the way he has improved across his major league career, the unprecedented things he's done. Please convince me that he will be pitching on Sunday.
Yeah, it was some unfortunate timing as I was finishing that story and he got scratched. but we decided to go with it anyway in large part because I was not concerned about the severity of the injury, of his lat soreness, and that he would be able to go, you know, he'd miss a start maybe two. And at this point, the Mets are optimistic it's just the one start. He played catch on Thursday. On Friday, he's going to play catch again. And if he feels fine after, I don't know how long a game of catch is before a bullpen session. I don't think it's terribly long. If he feels okay doing that, you know, off of what he did on Thursday, then he'll throw his usual side session on Friday. And if that goes well and he feels good Saturday, then he'd be in line for Sunday. If not, then he probably goes on the injured list and he gets pushed back a little bit. You know, he's basically said that, you know, your lat as a pitcher is sore after every start. And it's just a matter of, does it feel better with each successive day leading up to your next start so that by the day you start, it doesn't hurt anymore. And this time it didn't. It was on Monday. You know, he's scheduled to start on Tuesday. It was on Monday that he woke up and it was still, it had gotten sorer than it had been earlier. And he attributed that to his mechanics just being out of whack. Against Boston, which does parlay well into the story that I wrote about how much more efficient his mechanics have become over time in like very small and subtle ways. I talked to people who saw him in college. I talked to Dave Island, the Mets' former pitching coach, who was a big part of making a lot of these small changes. And I talked to some people at like Driveline who do much deeper pitching analysis than I am capable of on my own. And they pointed out like, the way he stays back on the rubber, the way he uses his lower body, the way he, you know, just like the way his ankle positions differently and drives differently off the mound are things that allow him to A, repeat his delivery more consistently and locate pitches better, but B, also add the velocity that he has in the last couple of years, that his body flexibility, which is unusual for a 32-year-old, that like he is still, it seems, as flexible now as he ever was. And that's something that doesn't have to do with starting pitching later in life than most guys. Also helps him do all of those things still the same way.
And so, I think it was a quote from the Driveline guy who said this is like a one in a million type outlier. Like it was bound to happen eventually that someone might be the pitcher who adds 5 miles an hour or 4.5 miles an hour, whatever it is, across his late 20s and early 30s. But this is, I mean, I guess it's just a reminder for all of us to appreciate this as much as I hope we do. This is not typical.
Yeah. I mean, it's really remarkable. Like it's not just that he's added 5 miles an hour at from age like 26, 27 to 33, which he is now, like that's a ridiculous amount of velocity to add at any point in your career, let alone one that's generally considered a time when you're losing velocity. You know, I looked at like the top 15 pitchers in wins above replacement since we have kind of consistent velocity data starting in 2008 with PitchFX, and no one else has added, you know, a couple other guys, I think it's Max Scherzer and Cole Hamels, have added like fractions of a mile an hour to their their velocity over that stretch. No one else has added as much as one. And DeGrom is there, I think, at 4.9. So just about five. It's crazy. And yeah, it was Kyle Boddy at Driveline who said, you know, you've got basically a million guys trying to do this. So it would make sense that one would succeed eventually. But it's just, I think, all the more remarkable that the one is this guy who in college was throwing 89 or 90 miles an hour. It's not like the foundation had been fully laid at that point for him to be this kind of pitcher later in life.
Well, like I said, it's an excellent feature. It's a fascinating read, and I would recommend anyone who hasn't checked it out yet to check that out. DeGrom's health is perhaps, you know, and this team will ride and rely on DeGrom to far beyond, you know, what's going on in the back end of the rotation. But even, I would say, called into focus more than ever because of some negative news about Carlos Carrasco.
Yeah, you know, I think earlier this week, the expectation, even earlier Thursday, the expectation was that Carlos Carrasco was going to make a rehab appearance, a rehab start this weekend on Sunday for a minor league affiliate. It wasn't clear which one. They hadn't gone that far. That would have been May 9th. And then you could have imagined him coming back to the major league rotation for his start after that around, you know, May 15th, May 16th, depending on how the Mets shook out their rotation, or, you know, at least with the time after that, by May 20th or 21st. The Mets, in reassessing his timeline, decided that he wasn't quite where they wanted him to be. You know, this is a guy who hasn't pitched against actual competition in 2021. You know, it's just been sim games and seeing his own uniform. He didn't get into any spring training outings. And we talked about how it usually takes those guys longer to build back up than you initially think, or that it would if they had spring training outings. And so they put him on the 60-day injured list. They needed to make room on the 40-man roster for Tommy Hunter, who had opted out and could become a free agent if they didn't add him to the roster. So they did that on Thursday, and Carrasco was the corresponding move. That means he cannot return until at least May 31st. It slows down it slows down the timeline, obviously. It's disappointing that it costs him probably 2 to 3 starts that he might have been able to make if everything were going in the initial timeline that they had laid out earlier in the week. But I don't think it's a bad thing long term for a guy who hasn't thrown a ton of innings the last few years for very justified reasons. And again, like, hadn't seen, you know, I was kind of leery of the idea of him making one rehab start and then pitching in the major leagues. Like, you like to see a guy pitch against actual competition for the first time in a really long time before you throw him in the deep end like that.
And I guess if there's a bright side to it, it's that by putting Carrasco on the 60-day injured list, they didn't put Seth Lugo on the 60-day injured list. And I think we had been under the impression that Lugo was a little bit behind Carrasco. That would give us some hope that we see Lugo before the end of May.
Yeah, I mean, Luis Rojas has said Lugo they expect back by the end of May. I don't know that we'll see him much before May 31st, which is the date that anyone on the 60-day IL, any of those guys who was hurt at the start of the year, can come back the soonest. You know, it might be that he comes up on the 28th or something, because he's still not facing hitters, which I think he was, when we talked about him with Rojas last week, it sounded like he was about to face hitters, and now he's still just throwing side sessions. So they still have this kind of vague end of May timetable for him. You know, this is, people talk all the time about how the Mets players don't come back on the proper timeline, and I think a lot of it has to do with the team being optimistic about injuries in a way it probably shouldn't publicly. And, you know, whenever you give a timeline for a guy and he doesn't hit it, fans get upset at him, which is not fair. So, Lugo was initially, 6 weeks? So the thought was maybe by this point in the season, we'd be pretty close to having him back. But it's still off-season elbow surgery. And again, like, didn't see anyone in spring, didn't pitch in spring training at all, didn't build his arm up. So he's got to start facing hitters and then build up a little bit. Not as much as a starter would, but still have a few outings in a rehab setting. So I think he's still probably closer to 3 weeks away than one or two.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And what have we got in terms of injury updates with J.D. Davis and Brandon Nimmo on the offensive side?
Yeah, that they should not take as long. Nimmo, you know, they waited a little while to put him on the injured list and played short for a few days, which is not ideal. And finally put him on when he was still feeling pain on Wednesday between games of the doubleheader. I think the hope is that is not much more than the 10 days, which would have him back on May 14th, I believe, against Tampa Bay. Davis is kind of the same thing. They hope it's like his first IL stint, that it's only the minimum 10 days. Same with Luis Guillorme, by the way, who I believe is eligible to come off this weekend. I think Sunday. So all of those guys, the thought is that these should not linger much beyond the 10-day time span of the IL. But you know, we don't know for sure about that until we get a little bit closer to the end of that time frame.
And in the meantime, there's talk that we'll see Khalil Lee at some point in Flushing soon.
Yeah, you know, they're playing. I believe that was reported by Anthony DiComo. They've been playing short on the bench. You know, they've been playing with a 4-man bench rather than the 5-man bench they'd had for most of the season. And when two of those four are catchers, in you know Nito and Patrick Mazika, it feels like you're playing even shorter because you basically just got two catchers, an infielder and an outfielder. You know, they've got some versatile, like Jeff McNeil can play the outfield in a pinch if they need to. Same with Jonathan Villar. But you'd rather have actual outfielders there. So Lee would be a guy who was on the 40-man roster. Like they have Janeshwi Fargas was on the taxi squad. They could have called him up in St. Louis, but he's not on the 40-man. You would have had to make another Carrasco-like move to get him there. It might have been Seth Lugo to the 60-day injured list. So you'd rather have a guy like Lee who doesn't take as much roster manipulation to get there. Sounds like he could be on the roster on Friday against the Diamondbacks.
One difference being there have been other players in Major League history named Khalil. Khalil Green comes to my mind. There, I am not certain there has ever been, and I have Googled this looking for it, I'm not certain there's ever been another person in human history named Janeshwi. And, like, that's it. I think it's it. And you know what I found while Googling it is he seems like he's a heck of a guy. Like, you know, like, cause you can go down to like 10 pages deep on Janeshwi returns on Google, and it's all about Janeshwi Vargas, and people seem to really like the dude.
Well, he did hit for the cycle in that spring training game last year, which I was on like March 5th or 6th, and just feels like the last time the world was normal. And so that will always be Janeshwi Fargas's, in the same sense that Ty's tacos will be Taiwan Walker's legacy to you, unless he throws three straight perfect games or something like that. Janeshwi Fargas will always be the guy who hit for a cycle and then the world came apart to me, unless he, I don't know, hits 6 home runs in a baseball game.
We've got a couple of questions from readers. The first comes from the very TD who told us about the Mets being friend-zoned in the most recent show. This one, not a baseball question, but one for you, and you do incorporate a lot of literary quotes into your work. He And I was a little offended by this. He is hoping to get your book recommendations.
Ooh, so let me see
here. I read
here.
Books too. Just a TD, I read books too, all right? I was on Jeopardy. I was on Jeopardy. It's not like I don't read books.
Jeez, sounds like someone's a little riled up.
I have a master's in arts and literature. I read some books.
Do you want to go first?
No, I don't. I don't. I want to hear what you're reading.
So what I'm reading right now, I just finished Infinite Jest, which I believe we talked about, that I took a very long time to read.
Oh, I hated it. I couldn't get through it.
This is my second time reading it. The first time I had been unemployed, so it was a little easier. That was in 2009. So this one took 3 months instead of like 15 days. But I enjoyed it. I like everything really that David Foster Wallace has written.
He's an incredible writer. I think he's an incredible writer, and like some of his essays are among my favorite, like sort of long form journalism type things. I found and my thinking on Infinite Jest, because I only tried to read it last year or 2 years ago. I think if I had read it when I was 23, I would have like completely loved it. But reading it as an old man, I just didn't have any patience for him. It was like, okay, I get that you can write, like he can put together a hell of a sentence. But it was just, it felt so self-indulgent to me. And I just wanted a heavier handed editor. And I know all about his whole thing where he would, you know, send like pages and pages of notes back to his editor and defend every single one of his choices. And maybe rightfully so, because he's David Foster Wallace. But I don't have the time for something like this.
Yeah, like I don't know if I hadn't read it previously and hadn't really enjoyed it previously, I might have put it aside at some point this time. It is a difficult read, but I think it's worth it in the long run. From a fiction side, let me see the books that I've liked lately. My favorite book that I read last year was Exhalation by Ted Chiang, which is just short stories, much easier to read. I thought that was really good. Among like authors that are in vogue currently, I really like Sally Rooney, like most people. I like Rachel Cusk a fair amount. I like the Outline trilogy, which I don't remember what any of them are about, but I just remember really enjoying the read. Other like classics that I've read recently for the first time and really liked, Middlemarch, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I read a couple summers ago. And then The Red and the Black by Stendhal, which is a book that like I had heard about for a while and I'd had on my, I bought in like my sophomore year of college, and I always considered reading it, but you know, you feel like you know basically how a 19th century novel is going to go. But I haven't read too many French ones. So I thought that was much better than I expected it to be. So I like that. And then, I know a lot of baseball fans, I think in particular, like history. So my two favorite, history books that I've read, in the last couple of years are, Constance Wedgwood's The 30 Years' War, which is just, it might be my favorite book that I've read in the last 5 years. It's about the brutal 30 Years' War in the 17th century. And it's just like really delightfully written about this brutal time. So there's a lot of fun sentences.
That was one of the wars that wiped out like an incredibly high percentage of Europe, right?
Yeah, and achieved almost nothing. Like very little had changed by 1648 that had been in 1618. And yet, just everyone's life was made much worse. So that was really good. And then Swan Song 1945 by Walter Kempowski, who's a German novelist, but he put together essentially, I believe this is the only portion of it that's available in English, but he went through and found like all of these people's journals during World War II and basically made a whole compilation of primary documents around the entire occurrence of World War II, the whole length of it, I think. And Swan Song 1945 is about the last couple days of World War II from, the perspective of German soldiers, Russian soldiers, American soldiers, citizens living in Germany and various parts of Europe, people who discovered the concentration camps and realized the extent and magnitude of what was going on there. It's a remarkable project and one that will stick with you for a while. So that was... That one is really good.
And then that's a good sell, yeah.
Anything by Dostoevsky, which is, I've read pretty much everything he's written, so.
I have recently. So I always generally, I typically avoid, and this is, I don't know, maybe this is like sort of exposes me as a rube. I tend to avoid works in translation just because I feel like the language is such an important part of writing, and like there's an art to translation too, obviously. It's just like a weird little thing that it's I prefer to know that the words I'm reading are the author's intended words. But I recently came to George Saunders' book, and George Saunders is an incredible American short fiction writer. He has a book called A Swim in the Pond in the Rain, and he picks apart, he is it's seven Russian short stories by like the Russian masters, Tolstoy and Chekhov and all those guys. And he sort of he gives you the story, and then he picks apart like why it works and how it works. And for any like aspirant fiction writer, it's an incredible book. And I've also just and completely unrelated. Evgeny Zamyatin is an like a Russian writer from the 1920s, and he wrote a book called We. I am a huge fan of dystopias in general, and We I believe was credited by both George Orwell and Aldous Huxley as like the foundational text behind 1984 and Brave New World. And with 1984 especially, as soon as you get into this book, We, it's like, oh, like now, and unfortunately it has made me like 1984 a little bit less because I realize that it's not so completely original. Like there's so many common ties. But that's been enjoyable. And I've recently gotten into Octavia Butler, who is an American sci-fi, a late American sci-fi writer and speculative fiction writer. And I read Kindred, which is an incredible time travel narrative. And I got into because I've been working on a time travel story myself. And it was good enough that I moved into some of her other works, including Parable of the Sour, which is an amazing dystopia. I like bleak futures in my reading. That's generally where I go. But that was unsolicited because TD didn't care what books I'm reading. Another question, a baseball question, and this is one we've I think tackled almost exactly in the past, but it's just something that keeps coming up. And this is from Andrew. He says, "What is your intense view of Ronnie Mauricio's long-term impact with the team? Seems like shortstop is out of the question. I felt like third base would be a natural fit. Heard he's playing some outfield. I guess he could be a trade piece." And so it's not in Andrew's question, but I guess this needling little topic that I keep seeing come up involving Mauricio is the notion that the Mets shouldn't have gone in on that big contract for Lindor because they have Ronnie Mauricio. And Ronnie Mauricio is a 20-year-old who has one season of full season ball under his belt. Granted, he was the youngest player in the league when he did it, but it wasn't like he was spectacular in that season. To me, it's just premature to even be worrying about this guy and a major league fit in any way. And that's not to knock him as a prospect. I don't know from prospects. I just don't think it's like you. It's just completely immaterial how he fits on the major league roster right now.
Yeah, he is right now not the same. He's a very good prospect that you can be excited about him as a Mets fan and what he can be at the major league level down the line. But at the same point in his career, Amed Rosario was a better prospect than Ronnie Mauricio is now. You don't, with
I mean,
that
you could go
history
down the
in
list and
mind.
find hundreds and hundreds of guys who didn't really pan out who were way bigger prospects than Ronnie Mauricio.
Right. So I
Yeoman
don't think
Young,
you
Lestings Milich, Fernando Martinez, right?
you don't change when you have the opportunity to get a here and now star like Francisco Lindor. You don't hold off because you've got a maybe in Ronnie Mauricio and a guy who as good as he's been in the minor leagues, you're still not 100% sure even if shortstop were open that that would be his long-term position. I think they've gotten more confident about it, but he's still relatively tall for a shortstop. And you weren't sure he was going to be like an average to plus defender there. So the thought was he might end up at third base anyway, or in the outfield, but that he has the bat to play in one of those spots. And that's he's got the athleticism to make that shift. If you can play short, you can play pretty much anywhere else reasonably well. you know, Rosario, we've seen make the transition to center field. I actually haven't checked on how that's going since spring training, but I think it's gotten smoother for him. That, you know, you give him enough time in the minor leagues, he'll be able to learn third or left or maybe even center if you need to go there. So I think, like, it's really not worth worrying how all of these pieces are going to come together, because they can make it work if it's worth making it work.
Yeah, if it turns out he's Cal Ripken, the second coming of Cal Ripken, they will figure that out, right? And the second coming of Cal Ripken would be like Brooks Robinson at third base. So you could handle that for sure. If you have a question for the Metrospective podcast, please email us. I'm at askTedBerg@gmail.com. I will relay that question to Tim on the air, or you can get at us on Twitter. Tim is at Tim Britton. I am at OG Ted Berg. And while you're interacting with us online, please do subscribe and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else where they will allow you to do those things with podcasts. Tim, we've got more baseball coming up this weekend, after which we will, of course, be back to talk about it.
And to preview a possible Matt Harvey start at Citi Field next week.
That is exciting. Thank you so much, and peace out.
Adios.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.